week before the exam. You will have finished studying the text, you will have practiced the exam process, and you will have listened to the preceding CDs. At this stage of your preparation, I thought you might find a last-minute review useful. There are three topics I have chosen for the clinical review: ACLS, the differential diagnosis of headache, and pediatric resuscitation. This may seem like an unusual combination to you, so let me explain the rationale of these choices. You must know the ACLS protocols. New guidelines were issued by the American Heart Association in December of 2005. These guidelines are available at the American Heart Association website. ACLS changes are outlined in a concise manner, listing the old standard, the new standard, and why the changes were made. Though too numerous to be listed here, they are reasonable in length and content. You should be familiar with these changes before taking the oral examination. Some of them are reviewed here, but you should get a copy of all the ACLS revisions and review them. The witnessed arrest is more frequently encountered, so I will review the witnessed arrest situations that are most likely to appear on this exam. Pediatric resuscitation is a topic that has appeared on this exam, and you will need to know correct drug dosages, at least for the arrest situation. Both arrest and non-arrest clinical situations are reviewed here. ACLS and pediatric resuscitation protocols are frequently complex and difficult to learn, so I separated these reviews for easier learning. The differential diagnosis of headache is right between them. The headache patient may or may not appear on this exam. However, it's a topic that I think merits review because if it does appear, certain pathologic entities should be ruled out. In addition to this clinical review, I have also included a last-minute review of key points in the exam process. This includes a case management checklist, critical actions, diagnostic clues, and exam techniques. I will start with an ACLS review of the witnessed cardiac arrest in the adult patient. This review reflects the revisions published in the Guidelines 2000, as well as those published in the December 2005 issue of Currents in Emergency Cardiac Care. All of these patients are on a monitor and have an IV established. Specific management of the following dysrhythmias will be reviewed. Number 1. Monitored ventricular tachycardia in a patient with a pulse. Number 2. Monitored ventricular fibrillation, which also includes monitored ventricular tachycardia in the unconscious, pulseless patient. Number 3. Persistent or recurrent ventricular fibrillation. Number 4. Pulseless electrical activity. And number 5, asystolic cardiac arrest. Specific management of monitored ventricular tachycardia in patients with a pulse is determined primarily by the presence of symptoms and the level of hemodynamic stability. An unstable patient is one with symptoms, especially chest pain or shortness of breath, hypotension, that is, a systolic blood pressure less than 100, congestive heart failure, myocardial ischemia or infarction, or an altered level of consciousness. An unstable patient in VTAC with a ventricular rate greater than 150 should be prepared immediately for synchronized cardioversion. Start with 100 joules and pretreat with a sedating agent such as Versed or Valium. If delays in synchronization occur, switch to unsynchronized shocks using equivalent energy. If the VTAC does not convert, then increase the energy level to 200, then 300, and finally 360 joules as needed. Remember to reset the sync mode after each synchronized cardioversion because most defibrillators default back to the unsynchronized mode. Once cardioversion is achieved, antidysrhythmic therapy should probably be given. The ACLS guidelines favor the use of amiodarone over lidocaine, and I think this is a good choice, especially in the elderly and those with progressive decline in cardiac pump function. IV amiodarone is administered as 150 milligrams over 10 minutes followed by a 1 mg per minute infusion for 6 hours, and then 0.5 mg per minute. If the patient's pulse and blood pressure are dropping after therapy has been initiated, slow down the infusion rate. Occasionally, it's difficult to distinguish VTAC from SVT with aberrancy. The odds strongly favor VTAC rather than aberrant SVT in a patient who is having or has had an MI. If the diagnosis of a wide complex tachycardia is in doubt and the patient is stable, obtain a 12-lead ECG. An esophageal lead may be helpful if the origin of the dysrhythmia remains in doubt. SVT with aberrancy is diagnosed only if QRS morphology is typical of bundle branch block. Any other morphology of the QRS in leads V1 and V6 is assumed to represent VTAC by default. Also, look for the following ECG findings that support the diagnosis of VTAC. AV dissociation associated with fusion or capture beats and or QRS concordance. Now, if you're looking at a rhythm strip with wide QRS complexes, look for dissociated P waves followed by relatively normal-looking QRS complexes. They will be interspersed between one or two wide QRS complexes. These P waves are capture or fusion beats. QRS concordance is another finding that strongly suggests VTAC. In this situation, all the QRS complexes are either upright or inverted in the precordial leads, or the QRS complexes are predominantly negative in leads V1 through V6. If the patient is unstable, treat with DC cardioversion or amiodarone. For the patient in VTAC who has a pulse and is conscious and stable, the first thing you need to do is to determine whether it is monomorphic or polymorphic VTAC. If the QRS morphology is the same, then the VTAC is monomorphic. Varying QRS morphology is called polymorphic VTAC. If the patient has monomorphic VTAC, which drug you give will be based on the integrity of cardiac function. If there is no evidence of pump failure, then procainamide is the drug of choice. Begin an infusion at 20 mg per minute and continue until one of the following occurs: suppression of the dysrhythmia, hypotension, widening of the QRS complex, or a total of 17 mg per kilogram has been given. If the rhythm converts at this point, follow with a procainamide infusion drip run at 1 to 4 mg per minute. If there is still no change in rhythm, amiodarone or lidocaine are other acceptable alternative agents. Now, if the cardiac function is impaired in the presence of monomorphic VTAC, administer amiodarone, 150 mg IV bolus over 10 minutes, or lidocaine, 0.5 to 0.75 mg per kilogram IV push, followed by synchronized cardioversion. If the patient is conscious, he should be premedicated with Versed or Valium. If repeated cardioversion attempts are needed, then use 200, followed by 300, and then 360 joules respectively as needed. Polymorphic VTAC is treated differently and depends on the duration of the QT interval, the history, physical exam, and lab evidence suggesting myocardial ischemia or infarction, electrolyte abnormalities, or known or suspected toxic ingestion or exposure. Order an ECG, lights, including magnesium and calcium, cardiac enzymes, and, if a specific toxin is suspected, a stat tox level for that substance. Now look at a rhythm strip and examine the QT interval. Is it normal or prolonged? If the QT interval is prolonged, is the rate slow? Bradycardia associated with a prolonged QT suggests torsade de Pointes and should be treated immediately with IV magnesium. If this is not the problem, you may go directly to cardioversion. If this option is not feasible, evaluate the diagnostic tests you ordered. Correct any electrolyte abnormalities. If the patient's history, physical exam, ECG, or enzymes suggest an acute coronary syndrome, go back to the QT interval again. If it is normal, a beta blocker and anti-ischemic agents should be given. However, avoid beta blockers if the rate is slow. If the QT interval is prolonged, strongly consider cardioversion starting at 200 joules. Overdrive pacing may be required to shorten the QT interval. While this is being set up, a trial of lidocaine or phenytoin may be helpful and may actually suppress the dysrhythmia. Lidocaine is a good choice if there is evidence of ischemia on the ECG. Phenytoin may work if the VTAC is secondary to a cyclic antidepressant or phenothiazine overdose. Monitored ventricular tachycardia with a ventricular rate greater than 150 in the unstable patient with a pulse who is unconscious, hypotensive, or in pulmonary edema must be treated immediately with unsynchronized cardioversion to avoid delay associated with synchronization. Once ventricular tachycardia has resolved, begin an IV infusion of the antidysrhythmic agent that aided the resolution of the VTAC. The infusion rate for lidocaine is 2 to 4 mg per minute. Phenytoin is 100 to 400 mg per day, and procainamide is 1 to 4 mg per minute. If cardioversion alone led to the resolution of the VTAC, the patient should be given a loading dose of lidocaine, not phenytoin or procainamide, followed by a lidocaine infusion. Administering a continuous infusion of a prophylactic antidysrhythmic agent is controversial. But unless or until data becomes available that negates its potential theoretical advantages, it is reasonable to continue an infusion of the drug associated with restoration of a stable rhythm. After conversion to a stable rhythm, examine the ECG for signs of ischemia or a prolonged corrected QT interval. Also, examine the ECG for downsloping elevation of the ST segment in leads V1 to V3 with or without a right bundle branch block. These findings suggest a diagnosis of the Brugada syndrome, a recently recognized inherited syndrome characterized by this typical ECG appearance and a history of syncope. Management of monitored ventricular fibrillation and pulseless VTAC is as follows. Parenthetically, if your patient is in VTAC, substitute the phrase unsynchronized cardioversion for defibrillate. Here we go. Establish unresponsiveness and pulselessness. Confirm the presence of VFib or VTAC on the defibrillator. Using a monophasic manual defibrillator, deliver a single dose of 360 joules. If unsuccessful, start CPR, beginning with chest compressions. Check the rhythm after 5 cycles of CPR or 2 minutes have passed. Intubate the patient during this time, and make sure an IV or IO line is in place. If the patient remains in VFib or pulseless VTAC, defibrillate again at 360 joules. If unsuccessful, continue CPR and initiate drug therapy with epinephrine 1 mg, which may be repeated every 3 to 5 minutes. Defibrillation with 360 joules should be carried out within 30 to 60 seconds of an administered epinephrine dose. If the patient converts to a rhythm that is accompanied by return of spontaneous circulation, then do the following. Obtain and assess vital signs. Check the upper airway for patency and support breathing. Administer medications appropriate for blood pressure, heart rate, and rhythm. If the patient still does not convert to a stable rhythm, then one of the following is likely to be present. Persistent or recurrent VFib or VTAC. Pulseless electrical activity or asystole. Management of these catastrophic post-arrest conduction disturbances will be discussed here. But before I get into that, there are 2 points about the VFib and pulseless VTAC protocol just reviewed that I want you to remember. First, Rapid defibrillation remains the main determinant of survival in cardiac arrest due to VFib or pulseless VTAC. And second, sodium bicarbonate should not be used routinely in cardiac arrest. Adequate ventilation remains the mainstay for control of acidosis in cardiac arrest. However, if the arrest occurred in a patient with pre-existing hyperkalemia, bicarb is definitely indicated. It is also indicated if the arrest was associated with either a pre-existing acidosis that is bicarbonate responsive or a cyclic antidepressant or phenobarbital overdose. Metabolic alkalosis is easily induced when bicarb is given early in a witnessed arrest. With an airway and IV established and early CPR performed, acidosis does not usually occur for several minutes. Respiratory acidosis occurs much more commonly than metabolic acidosis and is treated by improving oxygenation. Administration of bicarbonate should be guided by the bicarb concentration or the calculated base deficit obtained from ABG analysis or lab measurement, and only half of the calculated deficit should be given. Persistent or recurrent ventricular fibrillation or pulseless VTAC is often the result of inadequate oxygenation and/or acid-base imbalance. If ventricular fibrillation or pulseless VTAC persists or recurs after the usual ACLS protocol has been followed, consider metabolic abnormalities such as hyperkalemia and hypomagnesemia as possible causes of persistent ventricular fibrillation. Treat presumed severe hyperkalemia with sodium bicarb in a dose of 1 milliequivalent per kilogram. If the patient has a history of congestive heart failure, diabetes, or alcoholism, administration of magnesium sulfate is worth a try. The dose is 1 to 2 grams IV. Other potentially reversible causes of persistent ventricular fibrillation should be ruled out. These include hypothermia, digitalis toxicity, quinidine toxicity, and myocardial irritation from a pacemaker or intracardiac catheter. If VFib or VTAC persists or recurs after the above measures, administer one of the following medications: amiodarone, which is initially administered in this setting as a rapid infusion with 300 mg diluted in 20 to 30 cc's of D5W or normal saline. Follow in 30 to 60 seconds with defibrillation at 360 joules. Supplementary infusions of 150 mg can be repeated for recurrent or resistant dysrhythmias to a maximum manufacturer-recommended total daily dose of 2 grams. Amiodarone is now considered the drug of choice unless the VTAC is torsade de pointes or there is evidence of hypomagnesemia. Magnesium sulfate in 1 to 2 grams in 50 to 100 cc's D5W over 5 to 60 minutes IV is indicated for ECG evidence of torsade de pointes, which is an atypical VTAC, or suspected or documented hypomagnesemia. Procainamide, 20 mg per minute, may be given for recurrent or refractory VFib. The total dose should not exceed 17 mg per kilogram. Lidocaine, 1 to 1.5 mg per kilogram IV, may be given if all else fails. Once considered a first-line drug, evidence-based studies have not demonstrated its superiority over the aforementioned agents. An additional bolus of 0.5 to 0.75 mg per kilogram can be given over 3 to 5 minutes if necessary. For any med used, defibrillate with 360 joules after each dose. The pattern should be drug shock, then CPR. Here is a summary of the VFib pulseless VTAC sequence: shock, CPR, intubate, IV, epinephrine, shock, CPR, amiodarone, shock, CPR. Magnesium, if indicated, then shock, then CPR. Procainamide, if indicated, then shock, then CPR. Lidocaine, shock, CPR. Sodium bicarb should also be reconsidered at this time. Did this patient have metabolic acidosis prior to arrest? Is this an overdose patient? Any of the following overdoses require alkalinization therapy: cyclic antidepressants, salicylates, long-acting barbiturates, and chlorpropamide. The dose of bicarb is 1 milliequivalent per kilogram. Another overdose to consider, especially in the older patient, is a calcium channel blocker. In this case, administration of calcium chloride would probably be effective. The dose is 10 cc's of a 10% solution given IV over 10 minutes. Hypocalcemia, of course, is another indication for this drug. Does this patient have a history of chronic bowel disorder, such as chronic diarrhea or malabsorption syndrome? Other causes of hypocalcemia include renal failure, hypoparathyroidism, and acute pancreatitis. Now let's move on to the patient with pulseless electrical activity. What this means is that the electricity is still on, but the pump is functioning poorly, if at all. PEA includes any of the following electrical disturbances: electromechanical dissociation, also known as EMD, pseudo-EMD, idioventricular rhythms, ventricular escape rhythms, bradyasystolic rhythms, and post-defibrillation idioventricular rhythms. If you have identified any of these situations in your patient, then do the following. Continue CPR and intubate the patient. While you are intubating, ask the nurse to start an IV. Ventilate the patient with 100% O2. Listen for breath sounds in both lung fields and assess the ease of manual ventilation to rule out tension pneumothorax. Administer a fluid bolus to correct hypovolemia and assess peripheral perfusion using Doppler ultrasound. Check the patient's ECG for evidence of hypo or hyperkalemia or an acute MI and obtain a core body temperature to rule out hypothermia. While these steps are being taken, consider the possible causes of this patient's problem, as well as their appropriate therapy. It will be helpful in this respect to have a nurse or EMT obtain more history from significant others, like family and friends. Your approach will be guided by your clinical findings, the patient's medical history, and the circumstances which preceded the development of pulseless electrical activity. Among the possible causes are these: hypovolemia. Appropriate therapy here is volume infusion. Hypoxia. Appropriate therapy is ventilation. Cardiac tamponade. Appropriate therapy is pericardiocentesis. Tension pneumothorax. Appropriate therapy is needle decompression. Hypothermia, which should be treated accordingly. Massive pulmonary embolus. Appropriate treatment here is surgery and thrombolytics. Drug overdoses with cyclic antidepressants, digitalis, beta blockers, and calcium channel blockers, all of which may respond to appropriate drug therapy. Hyperkalemia or acidosis, both of which may respond to bicarb. And finally, massive acute myocardial infarction, in which case PEA is an ominous finding, since it is frequently associated with at least 40% myocardial injury. If PEA persists after BCLS measures have been carried out and you have considered possible causes, then administer epinephrine 1 mg IV push, repeated every 3 to 5 minutes as needed. If this approach fails, higher doses may be used, up to 0.2 mg per kilogram, but, as mentioned before, they are not recommended. If pulseless bradycardia exists, administer atropine 1 mg IV and repeat every 3 to 5 minutes as needed, up to a total of 0.04 mg per kilogram. These shorter atropine dosing intervals are possibly helpful in cardiac arrest. Now let's review the asystole treatment algorithm. In managing an asystolic arrest, it is important to first confirm the diagnosis. Ventricular fibrillation, which is a more responsive dysrhythmia, may masquerade as asystole if only one lead is checked. Always check two leads. If doubt still remains, treat as ventricular fibrillation. The sequence for treating asystole is as follows. Continue CPR, intubate, and obtain IV access. Confirm asystole in more than one lead. This can be accomplished in one of two ways. First, move the positive chest electrode at the left shoulder to the substernal area, or second, put on limb leads. Rule out any of the following as a possible cause of asystole: hypoxia, hyperkalemia, hypokalemia, pre-existing acidosis, drug overdoses, and hypothermia. If these conditions have been ruled out, then consider transcutaneous pacing. To be effective, transcutaneous pacing must be performed early, simultaneously with drugs. However, clinical evidence does not support the routine use of TCP for asystole. Drug therapy for asystole is as follows. First, administer epinephrine 1 mg IV push every 3 to 5 minutes. Bicarb should also be given if the patient has known pre-existing hyperkalemia. And second, atropine should be given if epinephrine fails. The dosing is 1 mg IV every 3 to 5 minutes, up to a total of 0.04 mg per kilogram. Consider bicarb again at this point if there is pre-existing bicarb-responsive acidosis, or for an overdose with cyclic antidepressants, or to alkalinize the urine in drug overdoses, or for those patients who have been in arrest for a long time. This is only acceptable for the patient who is intubated or who has return of spontaneous circulation. If the patient still remains in asystole after all these measures have been taken and no reversible causes are identified, consider termination of resuscitation efforts. This completes the ACLS review of those dysrhythmias and clinical settings most frequently encountered at the oral board exam. I recommend that you obtain a copy of the 2005 guidelines from the American Heart Association website, since there are some fairly significant changes I have alluded to on this CD.